Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's my colleague, Ira Melman.
A new national survey of the six largest Asian American registered voter populations in the United States says those voters could very well play a major role in the November U.S. presidential election. I spoke with Karthik Ramakrishnan, professor of public policy and political science at the University of California, Riverside, and the director of the survey.
So the major points are that Asian Americans are very highly motivated to vote this year. So we see that a majority are more enthusiastic than usual about voting this November. And if you combine that with the fact that you saw a record turnout for Asian Americans in 2018 for a midterm election, all signs are pointing to probably record presidential turnout for Asian Americans this year in 2020. And in terms of where people are leaning, we see that Joe Biden has a strong advantage. 54% back Biden, whereas 30% back President Trump, and 15% are undecided. And that 15% is higher than you see for the American average. And that's because most Asian American registered voters are naturalized citizens. So they didn't grow up in a Republican household or a Democratic household. And many of them have gotten naturalized over the last 4 to 8 years. So there's still a lot of room for persuasion. Now, you asked if there's any change over time. What we've seen since 2016 is that President Trump and candidate Trump now is doing slightly better among Asian American voters. And that's largely due to movement among two groups. So among Vietnamese American voters, he is winning the Vietnamese American vote right now, whereas Vietnamese American voters had backed Obama in 2008 and 2012, as well as Clinton in 2016. He also seems to have made some inroads in the Indian American vote. So he only got 16% of the Indian American vote in 2016. Now he's at 28%, whereas Biden is at two-thirds, at 65%, with 6% still undecided. And so those are the two groups where he's made significant gains. He has not done any better among Chinese Americans, and I think a lot of his rhetoric on China might have something to do with that.
Is there any reason being given, especially among the Vietnamese and the others that show increased support of the incumbent President Trump, for how they are feeling about this?
You know, it's hard to suss out from our survey data. You know, we asked whether U.S. foreign policy towards Asia was a was an important issue. It's not as high a priority as other issues like healthcare and the economy. So, just going outside of the survey context, you know, it seems like things like his very strong position on trying to contain China and to take on China might be playing a role, even though voters say that it's not that important an issue. Maybe it's playing a more subtle role there. Also, in general, we're seeing that, I mean, this is a shift that we saw even in 2018. So it's possible that Vietnamese Americans, especially the older generation, appreciate his general rhetoric and his policies of taking a tougher stance globally, as well as on some of the issues locally, including on immigration, right? So you would think Vietnamese Americans, largely refugee population, when we asked in 2018 whether different groups, whether they supported or opposed a ban on Syrian refugees, Vietnamese Americans were among those who were most likely to say they supported it. So there's a lot of complicated politics going on, I think, below the surface that I think helps account for why we see this shift.
What is the purpose of this survey? I mean, to what end is what I'm saying?
Asian Americans are poised to play a very significant role this year, including in several battleground states like Texas, like Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, Michigan. And in many of these states, the election is likely going to be decided within a couple of percentage points. And Asian Americans in these states are well within that margin of victory or defeat. So this is to show that this is an important electorate. Of course, these populations matter for many congressional races throughout the country as well. So the purpose of this survey is to provide data on what are the priorities of Asian American voters. It's not just about the presidential race or these congressional races. We have a wealth of information on where they stand on issues ranging from healthcare reform, healthcare for immigrants, gun control, and various COVID-related challenges. So this survey goes well beyond just conventional politics.
Karthik Ramakrishnan, professor of public policy and political science at the University of California, Riverside, and the director of the survey. A World Trade Organization panel ruled Tuesday that Trump administration tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods are illegal, vindicating Beijing even if the United States has all but incapacitated the WTO's ability to hand down a final binding verdict. The decision marks the first time that the Geneva-based trade body has ruled against a series of high-profile tariffs that President Donald Trump's government has imposed on a number of countries, allies and rivals alike. Trump has repeatedly claimed that the WTO treats the U.S. unfairly. In its decision, the WTO's dispute settlement body ruled against the U.S. government's argument that China has wrongly engaged in practices harmful to U.S. interest on issues including intellectual property theft and technology transfer. The ruling, in theory, would allow China to impose retaliatory tariffs on billions worth of U.S. goods, but it's unlikely to have much practical impact, at least in the short term, because the U.S. can appeal the decision to the WTO's appeals court, currently not functioning, largely because of Washington's single-handed refusal to accept new members for it.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
The World Health Organization is releasing guidance to minimize the risk of being infected with COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
As everyone in the world can attest, having a toothache is no fun. And when the pain is bad enough, people will go to the dentist. However, a World Health Organization survey of 103 countries between May and mid-July finds COVID-19 has affected dental services around the world in unprecedented ways. Dental officer in WHO's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases, Benoit Varenne, says 75% of survey respondents reported dental services have been completely or partially disrupted because of the coronavirus. He says the high level of disruption is linked to the nature of the work provided by the oral healthcare personnel.
As you know, dentists, dental nurses, hygienists, and dental assistants work in close contact with patients and are exposed to saliva and blood. And also they are using what we call spray-generating equipment. And all this equipment are generating what we call airborne particles or aerosol.
In communities where transmission of the coronavirus is high, Varenne says WHO recommends priority be given to urgent or emergency oral cases. And in the treatment of patients, he says dental workers should avoid or minimize procedures that may generate aerosols, which can spread the infection, and prioritize the use of hand instruments.
And of course, to delay routine, non-essential oral health care. This means oral health checkup, dental cleaning, preventive care, and certainly also some aesthetic dental treatment.
Other WHO recommendations include remote screening, maintaining physical distancing, and wearing masks before and in between dental sessions to prevent and reduce the risk of transmission. Varen says one of the most pressing issues is to ensure all dental workers have personal protective equipment. This is essential, he says, to protect themselves from becoming infected with COVID-19 and passing it on to their patients. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There is no current evidence that dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria, such as E. coli and Salmonella, that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit www.who.int. or www.cdc.gov.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Here's Ira Melman.
New York City has always attracted creative people, those who are happy to wait tables in the evening as long as it pays the bills, only to run to auditions and have time for their art during the day. However, the coronavirus pandemic has forced over 1,000 Big Apple restaurants to close, and that means no jobs for the New York City bohemia. Anna Nelson looked into how the New York art scene has been adapting to the new reality. Anna Rice narrates her story.
Among the tens of thousands of New York City waiters, many are aspiring artists or actors looking for a day job that'll pay the bills. They're following in the famous footsteps of artists like Sandra Bullock and Jennifer Aniston, and singers like Madonna and Mariah Carey. But over 1,000 New York City restaurants were forced to close because of COVID-19, and tens of thousands of jobs disappeared.
I used to work at Red Lobster. I used to work at Red Lobster. I served you. Good, good. I was a dishwasher. Used to scrape shrimp into garbage cans and then load up the dishwasher, man. And that was my real job.
Jen Lyon is a concert promoter. She says she has noticed fewer talented musicians available for work since COVID. Many have left New York City for good because restaurants and nightclubs are closed and can't accommodate them.
The Lady Gaga story. If Lady Gaga didn't play in small clubs in New York, we wouldn't have a Lady Gaga. Aren't we glad we have her? Bruce Springsteen. You know, I mean, all of these artists that make the stories and soundtracks of our lives, all of those artists who were working within the restaurant industry to maintain living in New York, to become artists, have now had to make different life choices and have had to leave New York.
Before the pandemic, one could spend an hour in line at restaurant Stardust on Broadway. Once inside the venue, waiters sang to entertain the customers.
You sing with all the voices of the mountain.
Today, Kevin Ray and Yulia Proshina, both former Stardust employees, are fundraising to support their fellow singer waiters.
It's about 200 plus people. Everybody is trying to find their own path right now. Some of them are creating their own music or something else. Some people are probably going in a totally different direction away from the music, which is kind of sad. We had a lot of talented people here.
The flexible work schedule allowed Kevin Ray to compose music and go on tours. Today, with future uncertain, he writes songs about 6 feet, the now notorious social distance.
It's everybody's livelihood. It's allowed us to live in this city. It's allowed us an opportunity to perform, to hone our craft, and to have fun while doing it.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, about 270,000 people worked in New York City restaurants before the pandemic. Today, it's less than 70,000. And while the dynamic continues to be like that, fewer and fewer young talented people will be able to afford to look for their dream in New York. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
We continue on VOA Asia. By the year 2025, half of the world's population, according to the World Health Organization, will be living in areas that are considered water-stressed. Several companies are offering solutions to clean and available drinking water by looking at what is in the air. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
This is no ordinary water cooler. The water here comes from the air. It's something Karthik Venkatesan would love his parents in India to have.
Whenever I go to India, I always use Dasani bottled water because I get sick if I use tap water.
Having access to clean drinking water is a growing global problem. Several companies have developed technology that uses moisture in the air and transforms it into drinking water. WaterGen's technology first purifies the air of particles. The air is then cooled until it reaches dew point. The water goes through another series of filters and an ultraviolet lamp to destroy microorganisms. These bigger machines have helped supply safe drinking water in countries including Sierra Leone and Vietnam, and also in the United States during disasters such as hurricanes. This smaller unit, called the Jenny, for the home or office, can produce an average of 30 liters of water a day.
WaterGen says the humidity in the air should be around 30% to maximize what this technology can do.
When you get up closer to 50, it works brilliantly.
Higher humidity also works better for Atmospheric Water Solutions' AquaBoy. Similarly, it creates drinking water while purifying the air and dehumidifying the room. Zero-mass water produces drinking water from sunlight and air, even in places of low relative humidity, using these hydro panels. The technology uses solar energy to raise the dew point inside the hydro panels, creating condensation. The cost of these various products run from around $2,000 and up, which may cost too much for households in many regions in the world.
India and Africa are all price-sensitive countries, so probably this price point may not work. But if the price point is right, definitely it has huge potential.
Creating drinking water from air, one solution that could alleviate one of the most basic human needs. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
A new report shows how the Chinese border town of Dandong continues to provide a vital lifeline for the North Korean economy. That's despite United Nations sanctions that have been in place since Pyongyang conducted a nuclear missile test 3 years ago, an incident that many feared could have led to war on the Korean Peninsula. The report authors say businesses based in Dandong are trading in goods that could be used for Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs. Henry Ridgewell reports.
North Korea's gateway to the world. The Chinese city of Dandong sits across the Yalu River from the North Korean town of Sinuiju. The Friendship Bridge connects the two countries, while Dandong's financial infrastructure plays a crucial role in sustaining North Korean trade. Research from the Royal United Services Institute shows that between 2014 and 2017, almost a quarter of North Korea's total trade flowed through only 150 Dandong-based companies.
And that may include a lot of illicit trade. For example, the US Treasury has designated in previous years many entities that are based in Dandong that have been active in illicit trade.
Of these 150 companies, just 10 accounted for nearly two-thirds of all the reported trade during the period in question. Five of these firms have since been sanctioned by the US Treasury for their links to the North Korean government and its nuclear and missile programs. All are still actively trading. In 2017, when Pyongyang carried out its sixth and largest nuclear test, the United Nations Security Council imposed widespread sanctions on the North Korean economy, including exports of coal and minerals. Those sanctions were backed by China. But the report authors say there's strong evidence that the Dandong-based companies continue to import materials from North Korea.
Revenue generation through coal exports, that would then be funneled through front companies in Hong Kong that shared identifiers with Chinese companies, such as phone numbers and locations, and office locations. Some of these companies would send items to Syria, Iran, Myanmar, countries that have had previous reported military relationships with North Korea. And then those companies would then procure items and send them to North Korea.
That includes dual-use items banned under international sanctions, such as advanced machine tools.
There's a whole range of things, and it's difficult to say for certain what is for the nuclear program and ballistic missile program and what is not. In terms of illicit trade going on right now, it is hard to say because the trade figures have stopped being reported by China.
The report's authors say Dandong-based companies are enabling North Korea to evade sanctions, raising serious questions about China's implementation of measures that Beijing itself supported at the UN Security Council. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. For years, U.S. businesses have been trying to get a piece of the huge Chinese market. And that's also true for Hollywood. However, as Disney is currently experiencing, doing business with China's authoritarian government can be tricky, especially in light of current political tensions between the United States and China. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
The pandemic is dealing a sickening blow to Hollywood. Theaters in key U.S. cities such as New York and Los Angeles remain shut.
With COVID, if the U.S. box office doesn't recover, the Chinese box office could overtake it this year.
China, the second largest movie market, is seeing a surge in ticket sales since movie theaters started reopening in July.
COVID has now made China even more important to Hollywood.
Chris Fenton, the former president of motion pictures for China-based DMG Entertainment, says even before the pandemic, Hollywood has been working hard for years to get into the Chinese market.
Hollywood said, you know what, we need to at least think about sensitive topics when it comes to China, for instance, Tiananmen Square or Taiwan or Tibet. So that at least has been a premeditated censorship by Hollywood starting in 1997. But the CCP's encroachment on fully operating inside the creative guidelines of what Hollywood does day to day has gotten more and more extensive over time.
But even with careful crafting of films, doing business in China has its perils.
She's both beautiful and strong.
Disney had high hopes for its movie Mulan. When Hollywood has been criticized for years for casting white actors to play Asian roles, Mulan has a predominantly Chinese cast, including actors Jet Li and Donnie Yen.
We wanted to make sure we had a full 100% Chinese cast, particularly because we've seen the backlash of films that have not followed that protocol.
The movie's release was delayed because of the pandemic. Now that the film is finally being streamed in the U.S. and released in Chinese theaters, there is controversy as viewers noticed some of the movie was filmed in Xinjiang, with credits thanking government entities there, where China is accused of human rights violations with mass detentions of the Muslim Uyghurs.
I think the issue is that we don't have visibility into why Xinjiang was chosen, and no one is willing to talk about it.
This comes after the Chinese-American actress who plays Mulan supported the Hong Kong police on social media last year during the mass demonstrations in Hong Kong against China's increasing control.
I think she is Mulan in the modern times.
From Thailand and South Korea to the U.S. and on social media, people have been calling for a boycott of Mulan. Disney has not responded for a request for a comment. Disney's troubles come at a time of political tensions between the U.S. and China. The New York Times reports the Trump administration is considering a ban on cotton products from Xinjiang. A Chinese spokesman says the U.S. is using human rights as an excuse to destabilize Xinjiang.
Xinjiang-related matters are not about rights, ethnicity, or religion, but about countering violence, terrorism, and separatism. The U.S. has no right or qualification to interfere.
In the midst of the Mulan backlash, Reuters reports Chinese authorities have told media outlets in China not to cover the release of Mulan in China. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. The economic impact of the coronavirus continues to linger in New York City. where lines to pick up donated food are still much longer than usual, according to a local charity group. Food Bank for New York City says it has distributed 30 million meals to New Yorkers. That's triple the number compared with last year. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
Food Bank for New York City says more people are showing up to receive food donations compared with the same time last year.
Year to date, we typically distribute about 10 million meals at this point, so we have already tripled that.
Janice Robinson, vice president of Food Bank for New York City, says she doesn't see an end in sight.
Sadly, New Yorkers are still struggling. People are unemployed and they're still having a need for food. Their children are being kept home, so those children aren't getting their meals at schools. So the need is only increasing.
Many in the line said they had been laid off because of the pandemic, and some said they were working but couldn't make ends meet without the help of donations.
It's a long line. But too many people, they need food. We don't have enough job, they lay off.
Some say costs also seem to be going up.
The kids are home, you're spending more money. It's like, come on. Then you have to buy equipment, you know, in order for them to be schooled properly at home. So you're spending more money and not receiving more money.
As people line up for food, the White House and Congress still haven't agreed on a second aid package. The last stimulus package provided $600 a week in supplemental unemployment payments, but that aid has expired in July. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. This year marked the 100th anniversary of U.S. women being granted the right to vote through the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. The amendment was introduced in Congress in 1878, and it took more than 40 years to be passed and ratified by three-quarters of the states. VOA's Deborah Block looks at the history of the women's suffrage movement and women's equality today.
Feminists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries championed women's suffrage in the United States during a long and difficult struggle.
There's a lot of ridicule and scorn that's leveled at these women.
The fight for suffrage began in 1848 at the first Women's Rights Convention held in a church in Seneca Falls, New York. Delegates at the convention crafted a document that called for equality with men, including the right to vote.
They said all men and women are created equal. They borrowed from the Declaration of Independence, but they made that very significant change, adding "and women."
As women fought for suffrage for more than 70 years, black women were not welcomed into the movement by whites.
But in their own organizations, anti-slavery societies, church conferences, civil rights organizations, and more, African American women over the course of two centuries developed their own women's movement.
As the roles of women were changing in the early 20th century, a new generation of women continued the struggle. They stepped up their protests, organizing parades, silent vigils, and hunger strikes.
They go out into crowds of men at factory gates at lunchtime and stand on little stools, and they give what are called stump speeches. They give speeches for women's suffrage in public to rowdy male audiences.
After President Woodrow Wilson changed his stance to support the amendment in 1918, it was ratified 2 years later. A century later, however, many women faced voter suppression, especially those who are black.
Disproportionately face voter ID requirements. They face polling places that are shuttered. They are purged disproportionately from the rolls.
Inequalities like these may be resolved through the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, proponents say, which was first introduced by suffragists in 1923.
You cannot discriminate on the basis of sex
And this would apply to the federal government and all of its policies and to the 50 states.
The future of the ERA is uncertain. But like the women who fought to vote, advocates say they will keep fighting for it. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. African Americans are nearly four times more likely to die of COVID-19 than whites, by one estimate. But polls show more blacks than whites say they will not get a coronavirus vaccine when one becomes available. A history of racism in medicine means trust in the health system is lower among African Americans. To help overcome those barriers, health officials are turning to a respected institution in the black community, barbershops. VOA's Steve Barragona neatly trims our story.
I get all my education from the barbershop news.
Fred Spry owns a barbershop just north of Washington. He's close with his clients, he says.
Most everybody cuts friends and family. And if they were my friends and family, they became my friends and family after knowing.
That intimate relationship between barber and client has deep roots in African American culture.
All this time throughout our history, black barbershops have been a place of refuge. They're like a sacred place.
What up, Fred?
Stephen Thomas heads the University of Maryland Center for Health Equity. He says that trusted relationship is an important one during the COVID-19 pandemic because trust in doctors is low in the black community.
For many African Americans, it's part of the oral tradition that you don't trust people in white coats who come into your neighborhood to say they want to help you.
Thomas says that tradition is rooted in centuries of racism, including unethical medical experiments involving blacks.
That's the zone of privacy.
Thomas says, though African Americans are dying of COVID-19 at much higher rates than whites, they are also more skeptical about a vaccine.
If it was available tomorrow, would you take it?
No.
No? Everybody's waiting for a vaccine.
I mean, you want my honest answer, or you want me to give it the political answer?
I want your honest answer.
But Thomas has a plan to build confidence.
No food, anything in the past 30 minutes, right?
No, sir.
For one thing, he wants black barbershops to offer COVID tests. For more than a decade, Thomas has been turning black barbers and stylists into health advocates. They've been helping educate their clients about conditions like HIV, heart disease, and cancer, which minorities suffer at higher rates than whites. Studies show it works. Fred Spry says when one of his clients got screened for cancer, his doctor found a tumor and removed it.
It felt good because I was like, I may have saved his life and it may have saved his family from having to mourn over him, you know, much earlier than they had to.
There you go.
Thomas is arming his network of barbers and stylists with COVID facts to combat misinformation. And with the coming influenza season threatening to make a bad situation worse, Thomas wants barbers to talk to their clients about flu shots.
We need to be working on that right now. The reasons why people are not taking the flu shot may be the same reasons they won't take a COVID vaccine when the time comes. Fear, mistrust.
That could change, he says, with a shave and a haircut and a word from someone they trust. Steve Barragona, Kensington, Maryland.
The coronavirus pandemic has caused colleges and universities in the United States to rethink how they will keep their students safe this fall. But in the case of sports, many institutions fear losing a significant portion of their revenue if games are canceled. Isha Sarai and Bart Vandiver have more.
Colleges and universities, many already under financial strain, could face additional funding hardships if they cut sports programs.
And, you know, there's never a good time for a pandemic, but for college sports, I think this was particularly bad because it happened right at the beginning of the men's basketball tournament. And the men's basketball tournament is the largest source of revenue for the NCAA.
According to figures from the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, college sports make roughly $1 billion annually in ticket sales and promotions for the universities. Athletic dollars from basketball, football, and baseball can contribute more than half of a school's operating budget.
That loss of revenue this year will be felt not just this year, but for the next several years to come.
Some of that money trickles down to students through financial aid. There are more than 20,000 international student athletes enrolled in competing NCAA schools. These schools provide more than $2.9 billion in athletic scholarships to students annually.
Prior to the pandemic, I was pretty confident that I would be able to get a scholarship with the improvements I would have made during the season. But because of the ending of the season, that didn't happen. Hopefully, in the end, I'll be able to still get a scholarship and still be competitive at the college level.
Some schools are pushing to go ahead with their college football season, a move that will require a huge increase in COVID-19 testing for their athletes.
They don't necessarily have the right resources to do all the testing. So it's a concern because I don't know of a university football team that hasn't had positive cases.
But Thomas Hoard, who is working with colleges and universities to increase their testing capacity, understands the push to not cancel sports.
The economic impact to the universities is huge, as you can imagine. I think the budget for football is like $500 million for Texas. And so it's not a small feat. What do you do with season ticket holders? What do you do with, you know, people that have already bought tickets? Can you refund all that money or have you allocated it somewhere else already?
Whether schools will delay sports seasons or be forced to cancel them entirely is yet to play out. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia comes to you daily from Washington, D.C. And if you've ever visited here, have you wondered where Washington, D.C. gets its singular good looks? A commission made up of experts in the arts has a say about almost every public building, monument, and space in America's capital city. VOA's Dora McCauer explains.
Washington is a monumental city, a showcase capital with iconic views. And that's because most planned public projects go through the Commission of Fine Arts, a presidentially appointed panel established by Congress in 1910.
The idea was to really lift the image of the city as an important international capital and to really push that idea of dignity and beauty and all these things that really contribute to the image of the city.
The panel guides the architectural development of Washington and advises the federal government on matters related to the arts and national symbols, such as medals and coins. One of its most recent high-profile projects is the new White House fence, which is in the process of being installed.
Basically almost doubling the size of the fence and give it some kind of, you know, blast and ram protection. So everything, all the pieces had to be beefed up.
And look good while doing it. Since the 2001 terror attacks, security is front and center.
You try to make it not look so much like it's there or find ways to make it feel like it's part of the visual environment. So it doesn't feel like you're going into a place that's really repellent. We actually work to try to make it still feel dignified and welcoming.
Pennsylvania Avenue used to be a busy main street in front of the White House. It was closed to traffic for security reasons in 1995. The Fine Arts Commission had a hand in making the secured area visually appealing. At the Lincoln Memorial, the reflecting pool serves as a security barrier, but visitors wouldn't know it. The same is true of the walkways leading to the Washington Monument.
It is perimeter security, but you don't really feel like it because it's actually a beautiful curving ramp that goes up to the monument itself.
Solar, storm drainage, and the urban landscape. These are some of the newest issues to come before the commission. The needs change over the decades, but the commission stays focused on maintaining a high-quality look so that the nation's capital never loses that special luster. In Washington, Dora McCuar, VOA News.
India and China have agreed to disengage their troops and de-escalate tensions that flared following a fresh dispute along their contested border in the Himalayan Mountains. However, analysts say overcoming their differences will not be easy. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
Pristine Pangong So Lake in India's eastern Ladakh region is where a four-month-long military standoff between India and China intensified recently after the Indian Army said it occupied hilltops when it noticed Chinese troop movements in the area.
There used to be that buffer which the two sides would respect. I think what has happened in recent crisis in the last few months is that Chinese have tried to gain an advantage over India by encroaching upon that buffer. And India is now realizing that they also need to have those kind of tactical advantages on the ground if they have to manipulate or if they have to manage China along the border. So I think that has led to this very peculiar kind of escalation.
The foreign ministers of the two countries agreed to disengage troops at a meeting held in Moscow that came days after both sides accused each other of firing warning shots for the first time in 45 years. Long-standing protocols forbid the use of firearms.
I would say it's very tense, and I stress the word very, because there are large number of troops massed on both sides, estimated 40,000 plus. More reinforcements are being brought in.
Overcoming differences will be challenging. Previous calls by New Delhi and Beijing to de-escalate tensions have failed to translate to action on the ground, with neither backing down from their differing perceptions of their disputed border.
As far as India is concerned, it's very clear that the Chinese have come in and we are not willing to accept that. They must go back to where they were. The Chinese position is that when, we are where we should have been. So that is the problem.
Restoring calm on the border will be key to repairing damaged ties. India has banned scores of Chinese apps, including the hugely popular video game PUBG and TikTok. It has restricted Chinese firms from infrastructure projects since the military standoff. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Faces covered in white dust and chisels in hand. Marble sculptors in Myanmar say the hills that have given them a livelihood for generations are disappearing, as large companies reap the rewards of the prized white rock. VOA's Keith Lane has more, narrated by Ira Melman.
The deafening sound of cutting and grinding machines, punctuated by the tapping of hammers and chisels, echoes around the hills next to Sagyin Village, north of Mandalay, Myanmar. The mounds, lined with jagged edges from where huge chunks have been cut, are the country's prime source of white marble, cherished as far back as the reign of King Mindon Min in the 19th century. Ko Lei, his wife, and their four children have carved a niche for themselves as the go-to sculptors for animals, making around $360 for each elephant, lion, or tiger figure. As he fashions the haunch of a 3-meter-tall feline that will one day guard the entrance to a Buddhist pagoda, he explains how important the hills are to everyone living in their shadow.
The entire village depends on this mountain, and we're worried it will disappear soon. We want this mountain back.
Like others here, he points the finger at shadowy Chinese and military-linked companies who were granted decades-long licenses over swaths of land under the previous government. Locals have always regarded the marble-rich slopes as their own and accused the outsiders of plundering their resources with explosives and excavating machinery. About 80% of the village of some 2,000 households work in the marble business, but people fear they're being pushed out. 55-year-old marble craftsman So Win says the big companies will destroy the hills until they're gone.
Since it's now in the company's hands, they can take it just as much as they want. They won't care if marble sculpting disappears. I'm very worried if it will still be here for future generations.
In recent months, a few dozen plots have been allocated to the villagers, says Un So Yin from the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environmental Conservation. But craftsman Yun Wai has not heard about the leases and is skeptical that locals will see dividends anytime soon. Wai says he learned to work with marble from his parents and grandparents when he was 14 years old and has built up a clientele as far away as Vietnam, Indonesia, and Australia.
The village's blood streams through these mountains. It gives us livelihood. This work keeps us alive, but we're scared our mountain will disappear and there's nothing we can do about it.
For Keith Lane, I'm Ira Melman, VOA News, Washington.
Now that you've heard our story, see it. Follow us on VOA Asia at YouTube. In this busy U.S. election year, a big event is coming up next on the calendar. September 29th is the first in a series of debates between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. VOA's Steve Reddish looks at the campaign road ahead.
This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny.
Now that the conventions have ended with Republican President Donald Trump and his Democratic Party rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, making their opening arguments.
This is a life-changing election. This will determine what America is going to look like for a long, long time.
Both candidates have gotten onto the campaign trail, honing their messages to voters in key states ahead of their first face-to-face debate on September 29th.
I think that we can expect to see a rowdy debate between the two presidential candidates.
Jennifer Murcia is a communications professor at Texas A&M University. She says both Biden and Trump are fighters.
And he isn't shy to do that, to mock people or to bully them during a debate. He did that in 2016. And with Joe Biden, what we've seen from him, you know, he sort of has a longer history of doing debates in politics. And what we've seen from him is that he's very willing to stand his ground. We saw in 2012 that his vice presidential debate was similarly, you know, I think it, to Trump in style, in that he sort of mocked his opposition a little bit.
Presidential debates have largely kept to a format of the candidates answering questions from a moderator.
It is actually informative to see both candidates in contrast to one another. So to hear how they speak, you know, the tone they use, but also to hear about their policies, it allows them to directly accuse one another of doing things, and it also allows them to make rebuttals so that they can defend themselves.
John Koch is the debate director at Vanderbilt University. He says there needs to be an evolution beyond what he calls press conference soundbites.
The debate would start with, here's the issue or the situation. You have 30 minutes or whatever it is to meet with your consultants and advisors, and then we want you to come back with a position, explain your position, and then we'll have a debate about how you arrived at that decision, and then the, you know, the quality of those decisions.
Whether viewership this year tops the estimated 84 million Americans who watched the first debate in 2016, it is questionable how many voters it will sway.
A lot of the research on presidential debates have shown that it kind of lets people identify with the candidate that they kind of already identify with. It just kind of lets them see who shares their positions, right? There's not a lot of evidence per se that it changes, presidential debates change minds.
I really think that, you know, for these debates to have any kind of effect like they should, the audience itself has a responsibility to listen with an open mind.
According to Pew Research, 10% of 2016 voters said they decided their vote during or just after the debates. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. We are all very aware that this year our home planet has got a lot going on. Fires in California have turned the skies orange. Flooding in Senegal and Sudan has farmers worried about the future. And fires have broken out in Beirut's port following last month's massive explosion. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us a special week in space with Eyes on Mother Earth.
This is the port of Beirut, 1 month after a blast that was so powerful it was visible from space. The August explosion of ammonium nitrate stored in a port warehouse killed almost 200 people, injured thousands of others, and destroyed homes and buildings in a vast area of the Lebanese capital.
The latest fire is in a tire warehouse, according to state media. The cause remains unknown. Meanwhile, in Sudan, authorities and the United Nations are providing aid to tens of thousands who lost their homes in recent record Nile flooding. Local resident Idris Ahmed wants international help.
What is the role of government? Nothing. They're not doing anything. I'm asking for rights as a citizen, looking for refuge. I go right, I go left. Is this something anyone can accept?
Across the continent, in Senegal, the town of Kerem Assar remains underwater after clouds dumped 3 months' worth of rain in just 7 hours over this area outside the capital city, Dakar. The flooding is creating even worse hardship for residents.
We are flooded. We're all going through the same problem. It's serious. Some people left. Some people are unable to reach their homes. Firefighters are helping evacuate with boats. It's really difficult.
Finally, this week, residents in California report awakening to orange skies raining ash as wildfires exploded out of control. In one day alone, climate scientists say one fire expanded more than 1,000 square meters. More than 14,000 firefighters are battling the California blazes. Two of the largest in the state's history are burning in the San Francisco Bay Area, though after 3 weeks, those are mainly under control. However, wildfire season has just begun. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. The economic impact of the coronavirus continues to linger in New York City, where lines to pick up donated food are still much longer than usual, according to a local charity group. Food Bank for New York City says it has distributed 30 million meals to New Yorkers. That's triple the number compared with last year. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
Food Bank for New York City says more people are showing up to receive food donations compared with the same time last year.
Year to date, we typically distribute about 10 million meals at this point, so we have already tripled that.
Janice Robinson, vice president of Food Bank for New York City, says she doesn't see an end in sight.
Sadly, New Yorkers are still struggling. People are unemployed and they're still having a need for food. Their children are being kept home, so those children aren't getting their meals at schools. So the need is only increasing.
Many in the line said they had been laid off because of the pandemic, and some said they were working but couldn't make ends meet without the help of donations.
It's a long line. But too many people, they need food. We don't have no job, they lay off.
Some say costs also seem to be going up.
The kids are home, you're spending more money. It's like, come on. Then you have to buy equipment, you know, in order for them to be schooled properly at home. So you're spending more money and not receiving more money.
As people line up for food, the White House and Congress still haven't agreed on a second aid package. The last stimulus package provided $600 a week in supplemental unemployment payments, but that aid has expired in July.
I prefer working than have to be sitting there collecting a check every week, but you know, it helped. But now that we're not getting nothing at all, I don't know, I'm going to pay my bills now.
Republicans and Democrats appeared to be deadlocked over a new stimulus package. The U.S. Senate on Thursday killed a $300 billion coronavirus aid package as Republicans and Democrats disagreed over the size and scope of the aid. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Doctors are warning that the global death toll from diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV could increase sharply this year because of disruption to health services caused by the coronavirus pandemic. One report warns that malaria deaths in Africa could double in 2020. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Sibongile Zulu is among the 7.7 million South Africans who are HIV positive. She takes a cocktail of antiretroviral drugs to suppress the virus. When South Africa imposed a coronavirus lockdown in March, Zulu lost her job. Weeks later, her local clinic began to run short of some medication.
I think for 2 months, I was using only one, that I was supposed to use two. And if I don't use both of them, it's a big risk. And I can get sick.
Across the world, doctors say the coronavirus pandemic and the subsequent lockdowns will likely hamper the fight against other killer diseases like tuberculosis or TB, malaria and HIV. Epidemiologist Dr. Salim S. Abdul Karim advises the South African government on the coronavirus and has led research into other infectious diseases in Africa.
People are scared to go to healthcare services. We have seen a decline in the number of tests for tuberculosis. We've seen a decline in the number of patients coming in to get their medications. So that's of deep concern because it could undo the years of work that it has taken us to get to this point.
TB cases and deaths have fallen year on year in South Africa and many other countries, but it remains one of the world's biggest killers, with an estimated 1.5 million deaths last year.
We know there's a 50% decrease in TB testing in South Africa at the moment, so people are not able to go to the clinic or go to hospitals and so on, and they're not being diagnosed with TB. And this means that they can then transmit TB further to other people, so it's just going to sort of snowball.
Malaria deaths in Africa could double in 2020, warn researchers from Imperial College London, unless disrupted services such as mosquito net distribution and malaria treatments are maintained. Despite the dire forecasts, Karim says there is opportunity.
The opportunity to look at integration between COVID, HIV, TB and other conditions, so that when we are investing for our coronavirus vigilance, we are benefiting not just the COVID epidemic, but the epidemics of HIV and TB as well.
Huge resources have been dedicated to the fight against the coronavirus. Doctors say it's vital that other deadly diseases are not neglected. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Drive-in movie theaters were once a big part of American car culture in the mid-1960s, but air-conditioned theaters eventually put most of them out of business. These days, with movie theaters shut down because of the coronavirus, drive-in theaters are experiencing something of a renaissance. VOA's Tawhid al-Islam visited a drive-in theater in rural Virginia and filed this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
For months, Americans have been without the joy of seeing their favorite actors on the big screen because of the pandemic. But while there aren't many new movies coming out right now, there is still a place people can go to catch a movie safely. It's that relic of an older America, the drive-in theater. The Stevens City Drive-In Theater in Western Virginia is about an hour and a half away from Washington, D.C., but that's not stopping a lot of viewers.
I used to come here a lot when I was little, and I loved the experience. I haven't been in a few years since then, but I just wanted to come back and see what it's all about.
It's really nice because you're outdoors, you can see the picture. Much, much larger than you're in a regular theater.
All the way back.
Thank you.
There used to be thousands of drive-in theaters in the United States, but today there are merely a few hundred left. But some that remain have become local institutions.
Theater is a local icon, so to speak, for us, and we enjoy the movies they play and just the atmosphere that they present.
Theater management says drive-in theaters are naturally following social distancing, since everyone either stays in or camp outside their cars. One thing that has changed, patrons dial in their movie via FM radio, because the speakers at each parking spot could possibly transmit COVID.
Some of our classic speakers are covered up. Those usually you can connect them and put them in the car, but they're made of the same material as playground equipment, and according to all CDC, it's a potential virus transmission spot.
Yet with cinema slowly coming back online, it remains to be seen if this nostalgia for drive-ins will last.
Get up there.
For Tawhidul Islam in Stevens City, Virginia, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.